For the last 5 years, General Taylor has been associated intimately with the making of Vietnamese policy decisions. As personal military representative of President Kennedy in 1961 and 62, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 62 to 64, and as our ambassador to South Vietnam in 1964 and 1965. And he is now special consultant to the president and accompanied him to the recent conference in Honolulu. General Taylor, we're very pleased to have you. Of course, we've had you often before and very familiar with you, and we welcome you to make whatever statement you choose.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for your willingness to hear my views on the situation in South Vietnam. I'm afraid that they will not be new to many of you, since you have often heard me express them in the days when I was an official of the government. I agree thoroughly with the motivating purpose of these hearings, namely to analyze the reasons why we're involved in South Vietnam, the importance of this involvement, and the effectiveness with which we are dealing with the resultant problems. If my personal views can assist in clarifying these points, I shall be most happy to present them. For the purpose of providing a basis for our subsequent discussion, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a continuous statement which will undertake to answer three basic questions. First, what are we doing in South Vietnam? Secondly, how are we doing it? And finally, can we improve upon what we're doing? A simple statement of what we're doing in South Vietnam is to say that we are engaged in a clash of purpose and interest with the militant wing of the communist movement represented by Hanoi, the Viet Cong, and Peking. Opposing these communist forces, in the front rank stand the government and the people of South Vietnam, supported primarily by the United States, but assisted in varying degree by some 30 other nations. The purpose of the Hanoi camp is perfectly clear and has been since 1954. It is to absorb the 15 million of South Vietnam into a single communist state under the leadership of Ho Chi Minh and his associates in Hanoi. In the course of accomplishing this basic purpose, the communist leaders expect to undermine the position of the United States in Asia and to demonstrate the efficacy of the so-called War of Liberation as a cheap, safe, and disavowable technique for the future expansion of militant communism. Our purpose is equally clear and easily defined. In his Baltimore speech of April 7, 1965, President Johnson did so in the following terms. Our objective is the independence of South Vietnam and its freedom from attack. We want nothing for ourselves, only that the people of South Vietnam be allowed to guide their own country in their own way. This has been our basic objective since 1954. It has been pursued by three successive administrations and remains our basic objective today. Like the communists, we have secondary objectives derived from the basic one. We intend to show that the War of Liberation, far from being cheap, safe, and disavowable, is costly, dangerous, and doomed to failure. We must destroy the myth of its invincibility in order to protect the independence of many weak nations which are vulnerable targets for subversive aggression, to use the proper term for the War of Liberation. We cannot leave while force and violence threaten them. The question has been raised as to whether this clash of interests is really important to us. An easy and incomplete answer would be that it must be important to us, since it is considered so important by the other side. Their leadership has made it quite clear that they regard South Vietnam as the testing ground for the War of Liberation. And after its anticipated success there, it will be widely used about the world. Kosygin told Mr. Reston in his interview of last December, "We believe that national liberation wars are just wars, and they will continue as long as there is national oppression by imperialist powers." Before him, Khrushchev in January of 1961 had the following to say. "Now a word about national liberation war. the armed struggle by the Vietnamese people or the war of the Algerian people serve as the latest example of such wars. These are revolutionary wars. Such wars are not only admissible, but inevitable. Can such wars flare up in the future? They can. The communists fully support such just wars and march in the front rank of peoples waging liberation struggles. General Giap, the commander-in-chief of the North Vietnamese forces, has made the following comment. South Vietnam is the model of the national liberation movement of our time. If the special warfare that the United States imperialists are testing in South Vietnam is overcome, then it can be defeated anywhere in the world. The Minister of Defense of Communist China, Marshal Lin Piao, in a long statement of policy in September 1965, described in detail how Mao Zedong expects to utilize the War of Liberation to expand communism in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. These testimonials show that apart from the goal of imposing communism on 15 million South Vietnamese, the success of the War of Liberation is in itself an important objective of the communist leadership. On our side, we can understand the grave consequences of such a success for us. President Eisenhower in 1959 stressed the military importance of defending Southeast Asia in the following terms. He said, strategically, South Vietnam's capture by the communists would bring their power several hundred miles into a hitherto free region. The remaining countries of Southeast Asia would be menaced by a great flanking movement. The loss of South Vietnam would set in motion a crumbling process, which could, as it progresses, have grave consequences for the forces of freedom. Now, this view has often been referred to as the domino theory. I personally do not believe in such a theory if it means belief in a law of nature which requires the collapse of each neighboring state in an inevitable sequence following a communist victory in South Vietnam. However, I am deeply impressed with the probable effects worldwide, not necessarily in areas contiguous in South Vietnam, if the War of Liberation scores a significant victory there. President Kennedy commented on this danger with moving eloquence. He said, the great battleground for the defense and expansion of freedom today is the southern half of the globe, Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East, the lands of the people who harbor the greatest hope. The enemies of freedom think they can destroy the hopes of the newer nations, and they aim to do it before the end of this decade. This is a struggle of will and determination, as much as one of force and violence. It is a battle for the conquest of the minds and souls as much as for the conquest of lives and territory. In such a struggle, we cannot fail to take sides. That ends the quotation from the president. Gentlemen, I think a simple answer to the question, what are we doing in South Vietnam, is to say that for more than a decade, we have been taking sides in a cause in which we have a vital stake. My second question was, how are we doing in the pursuit of our objectives in South Vietnam? Both sides in the struggle have over the years developed the current strategies which are now in confrontation. During 1964 and 1965, the Hanoi leadership attempted to exploit the political turbulence which followed the fall of President Diem in November 1963. Greatly encouraged by the disorder which marked the political scene in Saigon, the communist leadership made a massive effort to press on to victory. To meet the growing needs in military manpower, they began the infiltration of personnel of the North Vietnamese Army, first as individual replacements, later as formed tactical units. Utilizing this new strength, they intended to make the monsoon offensive of 1965 a major drive for significant military victories. Concurrently, they increased the sabotage directed at the land communication system in South Vietnam for the purpose of hampering the distribution of commodities and thus adding to the economic stresses in the South. Terrorism was stepped up and directed with added frequency at United States personnel and installations. They apparently hoped to be able to seize and hold politically important localities such as district and provincial capitals, to demoralize the Vietnamese people and government, and to demonstrate to the United States that we were backing a cause which must inevitably fail. Faced with this growing threat, the Vietnamese government and our American officials were obliged to develop a counter-strategy to blunt and defeat the intensified efforts of our adversaries. It evolved out of the experience of the preceding months and years and assumed its full form with the critical decisions in 1965 to introduce United States ground forces and to initiate the bombing campaign against military targets in the north. Both of these courses of action had been under consideration at least since November 1961, when I presented my report to President Kennedy following a visit to Saigon to appraise the growing criticality of the situation there. We did not take either action at that time, but my report contained the following comment with regard to the possible necessity of using air power against the source of the Viet Cong support in North Vietnam. I quote, "While we feel that the program recommended represents those measures which should be taken now, I would not suggest that it is the final word. It is if the Hanoi decision is to continue the irregular war declared on South Vietnam in 1959 with continued infiltration and covert support of guerrilla bands in the territory of our ally, we will then have to decide whether to accept as legitimate the continued guidance, training, and support of a guerrilla war across an international boundary. Can we admit the establishment of the common law that the party attacked and his friend are denied the right to strike the source of the aggression after the fact of that external aggression is clearly established?" End of the quotation. By February 1965, it became clear that we could no longer tolerate this clandestine support from the immune sanctuary in North Vietnam, which served as the external base for the Viet Cong insurgency. In brief, the strategy which we have been and are pursuing consists of four components. The first includes the many activities directed at increasing the effectiveness of our ground combat against the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese units in South Vietnam. For this purpose, we have made the utmost efforts to increase the indigenous forces of South Vietnam. Always mindful that this is a Vietnamese war in which we should do only those things which the Vietnamese cannot do for themselves or cannot do in time to avert defeat. From July 1965, the armed forces and police of South Vietnam were increased by some 140,000 trained men. A very creditable effort on the part of this small country, where military leadership and administrative experience are inevitably in short supply. As of today, the overall strength in South Vietnam is approaching 700,000, the largest military force in being among all of our allies worldwide. Encouraging though the results have been in increasing the Vietnamese strength, during the year cited, our intelligence authorities believe that the Viet Cong increased their total strength by some 60,000. In other words, we were advancing at a rate only a little better than 2-to-1 in our favor. Since history has shown that the government forces successfully opposing a guerrilla insurgency in the past have required a much greater preponderance of strength, 10-to-1 or 12-to-1, for example, it was quite clear that the Vietnamese could not raise forces fast enough to keep pace with the growing threat of the Viet Cong in time. It was this sobering conclusion that led to the decision to introduce ground forces with their unique mobility and massive firepower to compensate for the deficiency in Vietnamese strength. With such forces available, it was felt that the ratios of required strength cited above would lose much of their validity. I'm thoroughly aware, Mr. Chairman, of the concern of this committee over the growing requirement for American troops in South Vietnam. Is this an endless requirement in an open-ended war? I do not believe that anyone can give a completely satisfactory reply to this question, but I can suggest the consideration of certain limiting factors which have a bearing on the matter. First, on our side, we are not setting as an objective for our ground forces the occupation of all South Vietnam, or the hunting down of the last armed guerrilla. We are in Vietnam to safeguard the people, who are the real target of the enemy. Terrain has little meaning except insofar as it supports people. Thus, the extent of control and protection of population is the true measure of progress rather than the control of territory. By the former indicator, we're not doing too badly. Senator Mansfield estimates in his recent report that the government controls about 60% of the population, the Viet Cong about 22%, leaving 18% contested. When I left Saigon last July, those figures were 53%, 25%, and 22%. The point I wish to make is that when one expresses our military objective in terms of securing a high proportion of the population, the troop requirement loses some of its impression of open-endedness. Under this concept, the prime target of our United States forces becomes the mainline enemy unit, which constitute the greatest threat to population, not the entire guerrilla force wherever found. Another limiting factor is the logistic difficulty of the Viet Cong in supporting increased numbers of troops in combat. The combination of air attacks on their lines of supply and of increasing ground attacks on their units, which must then consume supplies at an increased rate, places some kind of ceiling on the forces they can maintain in South Vietnam. I wish I knew exactly where that ceiling is, but our basic data on Viet Cong logistics are too uncertain to permit precision. But the point is that there are factors which tend to keep our troop requirement finite and limit the capability of Hanoi to support large numbers of additional forces in the south. The second component of our strategy relates to the use of air power against military targets in North Vietnam. Now, it is well to remind ourselves the reasons which impelled us to this decision. There were three which we recognized perfectly at the time of the decision and which remain valid today. The first was to give the people of South Vietnam the assurance for the first time of imposing a direct penalty on the source of the aggression. For 11 years, they had suffered the depredations of the Viet Cong without exacting any price from the country which provided the direction and support. The morale of the people and that of the armed forces in Vietnam received an inestimable lift from the decision to use the air forces of both our countries against military targets in the homeland of the enemy, a lift which has certainly contributed to sustaining their will to continue the fight. The second reason for the decision to use air power, insofar as it could be effective, to limit and render more difficult the infiltration of men and supplies from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. It was perfectly clear from the start, and it is clear today, that air power would not be able to stop infiltration. We were quite sure, however, that it could impose a ceiling on the forces which could be sustained in combat in South Vietnam. I do not believe that anyone who has reflected on the effect of the destruction of bridges, ports, rail yards, and similar facilities, and on the effect of the limitation of daylight movement on the road throughout a large part of North Vietnam, can avoid the conclusion that the air campaign has had an important effect in slowing down infiltration and in raising its price. A testimonial to its effectiveness was the feverish activity in North Vietnam during the bombing pause to repair damage and to move transport in daylight. The third reason for the decision to use our air power was to provide a sobering reminder to the leaders in Hanoi that progressively they must pay a mounting price for the continuation of their support of the Viet Cong insurgency. In spite of their defiant statements of determination to endure these attacks forever, I, for one, know from experience that no one derives any enjoyment from receiving incoming shells and bombs day after day. And I have no doubt that the warning message is getting through to the leadership in Hanoi. In a very real sense, the objective of our air campaign is to change the will of the enemy leadership. We hope that in due course, the combination of Viet Cong's failure to win victory on the ground in South Vietnam and the effect of continued attacks, air attacks, will present to the Hanoi leadership a situation so disadvantageous that they will decide that it is in their interest to halt their aggression, redefine their aims, and join with us in discussing ways and means of improving the lot of all Vietnam. The third component of our current strategy includes all of those non-military activities which are so important, but which receive too little public attention. It is not that our leaders have been unaware of the importance of better government, better living conditions, and the promise of a better future for the people of this country. Unfortunately, lack of security and government instability were for a long time factors limiting the effectiveness of the many programs for development and reconstruction. But now, with the growing military effectiveness of our forces on the ground and the slowly developing maturity of the civil leadership in Saigon and in the provinces, I hope that conditions will permit much greater progress than in the past in bringing the benefits of a comparatively normal life to this war-weary people. I am obliged to feel that the Hanoi leadership is not yet convinced that it must mend its way. Perhaps they still hope for some kind of military victory in the South. Certainly they are not convinced that in some way the United States cannot be detached from the support of South Vietnam. They hope against hope that through international or domestic pressure, our government can be forced off course. They have not forgotten that the Viet Minh won more in Paris than in Dien Bien Phu, and believe that the Viet Cong may be as fortunate in Washington. They doubt the will of the American public to continue the conflict indefinitely. In a contest of patience, they expect to win, even though North Vietnam, like the South, has been constantly at war for over 20 years. Until it becomes perfectly clear to them that we are going to stay on course regardless of anything they do, I am afraid we are not likely to see them at a conference table. Or if they come unconvinced of the inevitability of the failure of their present course, we can expect them to stall, delay, and maneuver, just as they did in Panmunjom in Korea for over 2 years. In summary, then, our four-point strategy consists of a complex but coherent package of measures designed to improve the effectiveness of our forces on the ground in South Vietnam, to exploit our air superiority by attacking military targets in North Vietnam, to stabilize the political, social, and economic systems in South Vietnam, and to seek an honorable, negotiated settlement of the conflict. It is limited as to objective, as to geographical scope, as to weapons and forces employed, and as to targets attacked. All parts of it are interrelated. All parts are indispensable. We must be successful on all fronts. The key, I believe, is inexorable pressure at all points, directed at the will, the ability, and the means of the communist aggressor. It is a fair question to ask whether this is the best strategy to attain our basic objective. I am the first to concede that we can and must do better in all four categories of our efforts. But unhappily, progress toward peaceful negotiations is a bilateral affair, which can progress only with some cooperation from Hanoi. And as you know, thus far, that cooperation has been withheld. Having conceded the need and the possibility for improvement within the components of our current strategy, I must add in honesty that I know of no new strategic proposal which would serve as a better alternative to the one which I have described. That is, provided we do not sacrifice our basic objective, to button up our troops in defensive positions and thus to sacrifice their unique attributes of mobility and firepower, would constitute the abandonment of our lives on the battlefield and would assign a most inglorious mission to our troops, who for the present have high morale and complete confidence in their ability to cope with the Viet Cong in the field. The effect of such behavior on our Vietnamese allies could be disastrous. At a minimum, it would destroy all confidence in Vietnam and ultimate success, and would encourage the timid and the wavering to turn to the Viet Cong for protection and to the Liberation Front for political accommodation. Another serious result of such passivity would be the impossibility of obtaining honorable terms at any peace table. The communists are tough enough to deal with when one has the upper hand. They would never give us acceptable terms if the military situation reflected weakness on our part and a readiness to withdraw. Our only alternative would be to accept dishonorable terms or to continue to sit out the war indefinitely on a supine defensive. I can hardly see the American public or this Congress long supporting such a course of action. Thus, I am obliged to conclude that the so-called holding strategy is really not an alternative way of reaching our objective of an independent South Vietnam free from attack. We could never reach it on such a course. Rather than being a true alternative, it amounts to the modification and erosion of our basic objective, and hence appears to me to be unacceptable. In conclusion, I feel that our present strategy is the best that has been suggested, and that it is important that we adhere to it, always striving to improve our performance within the confines of its general concept. Certainly, it is not without risk, but little of value in this world is accomplished without risk. It seems to me that the risks entailed are warranted by the importance of our stake in Southeast Asia. Congress recognized this importance in the wording of the joint resolution of August 1964. I quote, "The United States regards as vital to its national interest and the world peace the maintenance of international peace and security in Southeast Asia." I subscribe to those words and believe we should live by them, and by the words of President Johnson when he said, in regard to our commitment in South Vietnam, "We will not be defeated. We will not grow tired. We will not withdraw, either openly or under the cloak of a meaningless agreement." Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. General Taylor. General Taylor, before I resume the principal question, there's just one statement you made that puzzled me greatly. On page 12, you say they have not forgotten that the Viet Minh won more in Paris than in Dien Bien Phu, and believe that the Viet Cong may be as fortunate in Washington. What did they win more in Paris than in Dien Bien Phu?
It was the weakening will to continue the conflict, which had been growing over the months and years, and the fact that the home front and the political front had reached the conclusion that the struggle in South Vietnam was hopeless, and hence they must end it very rapidly. You will recall that Mondes, France, at the time of the Geneva Accords, arbitrarily set the date, I believe, of July 20th, by which the French would get out regardless of the status of the agreement. Whereas Dien Bien Phu, while a military defeat in which the French lost some 25 or 30,000 troops, represented only a serious military setback, not a Waterloo.
Oh, you don't consider Dien Bien Phu as a decisive battle?
It was, in the sense, it tilted the scale of decision. But actually, for the French had strong military forces which were not involved in Dien Bien Phu at all, who could have continued the conflict.
I'm glad to have that information. I'd always been under the impression that it was Dien Bien Phu was a rather decisive battle, and that the Viet Minh felt that they had won the war at that time.
I'm sure they did, because it was the
How long after Dien Bien Phu were the meeting of Geneva convened?
I believe going on at the time. I'd have to check the historical record.
I think it was the next day, wasn't it, or a couple of days later?
It was very, they were almost concurrent, if not concurrent, as I recall.
I think it was. General, not being a military man, as you know, I would not wish to argue about, at this point at least, the strategy. I'm not capable of the strategy of pursuing the war. From my point of view, the validity of our involvement there is even more important. I think that there's no question that if we wish to bring all of our power to bear, we can completely annihilate this small country. As you've already pointed out, there are 15 million people, and they're very poor people, are they not? I mean, there's no industrialization of any consequence. They do not make planes, missiles, tanks, or anything of that character. And I'm sure we could completely crush them to dust and rubble if we wish to do so. And I wouldn't doubt the capacity of our military people. I have the greatest confidence in their capacity to do this job. Now, what does worry me as a representative of ordinary civilians in Arkansas as to whether or not we are justified in pursuing this to this course. And therefore, my mind has been attracted by that part of this controversy as to whether or not we ought to pursue this. I know this is a very unpopular way to look at it, but you quote on page 3 the word about national liberation wars. The armed struggle by the Vietnamese people or the war of the Algerian people serve as the latest example of such wars. These are revolutionary wars. Such wars are not only admissible but inevitable. Can such wars flare up in the future? They can. Well, I was reminded that, how would you describe the war of 1776? Was that a war of national liberation or wasn't it? What kind of a war did we fight in 1776? How would you describe it?
May I go back and pick up two or three of your comments previous to that one, Senator? First, I hope my statement is made clear that it is not our objective to crush or destroy North Vietnam. We are trying to change the will of the leadership in Hanoi. I like to quote a sentence from the Greek historian Polybius, who wrote 125 years before Christ. He says, I think very wisely in its application today, it is not the purpose of war to annihilate those who provoke it, but to cause them to mend their ways. I would make this point very strongly, Senator. We're trying to make them mend their ways, not to accept destruction.
What about the people of South Vietnam? We are causing much more damage to them than we are in North Vietnam. I mean, take Vietnam as a whole. We'll come back to this question of whether these are two different countries.
I would like also to comment on your Algerian comment, Senator. I suggest perhaps a feeling that the situation in Algeria and in South Vietnam today are comparable. Of course, they're not. In Algeria, there was the resistance to a colonial rule.
That's right.
At the present time, there is not a resistance to a colonial rule, except unless one wants to view the communist aggression as a form of colonial aggression, and I think that would be a fair...
I wouldn't wish to put it this way, but unless you would want to say we are the colonial, having stepped into the shoes of the French. Some people put it that way. I don't put it that way. But isn't the origin of this struggle in Vietnam an effort by the Vietnamese people to throw off the colonial domination of the French?
It was, and that was successful. Whereupon
that
the communists then tried to impose their colonial.
But wasn't
rule.
Wasn't it a group who succeeded in throwing out the French, largely influenced, if not dominated, by communist leadership under Ho Chi Minh?
Largely, but not entirely. Many of our friends in South Vietnam today fought against the French, and they're violently anti-French.
That's quite...
Keep making speeches while he's trying to answer your
question, sir. I wonder if the leader, he isn't leader of this committee, if he'd wait his turn, please.
I'd like to hear the answer to your question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you have your turn to say what you please. You said it yesterday. You can say it again today for the microphone. Continue, General.
I was simply making the point that any analogy between the Algerian situation and that today in South Vietnam is not accurate in my judgment. With regard to 1776, again, I would find great difficulty in finding any similarity between the action of the American colonists.
I ask you, how would you characterize the revolution in 1766?
As a civil revolution against a colonial power.
That's right. And it was very similar as the original revolution of the Vietnamese against the French, wasn't it?
It is, but not the situation today, sir.
I understand that, General. I was just trying to pursue the origin of this struggle. I realize it's changed considerably. But it began that way, and they've succeeded, we think, or some of us have thought, at Dien Bien Phu. Is that not correct?
Dien Bien Phu, as I say, was the climactic point. But the real reason for collapse of the French was the home front rather than the military front in South Vietnam.
Well, I don't know what evidence you have for that. It's been the general impression that Dien Bien Phu was quite a blow to the French. And they decided it was hopeless, and they negotiated almost immediately thereafter. They went to Geneva and agreed to a ceasefire. Is that not historically correct?
The first Battle of the Marne also was a very great defeat for the French, but at that time there was no weakness on the home front, hence they continued and won. In other words, a battle is important largely as it relates to the home situation. In that sense, Dien Bien Phu was indeed very critical.
Well, I don't think that the Marne is quite comparable. This was a genuine revolt against colonial domination, and people often fight with a great deal of tenacity. And the French, I think, if I read it correctly, had decided it was a hopeless struggle. There may be many elements entering into it, but surely Dien Bien Phu was one of them. And that the Vietnamese had mounted a long and a very costly war. We ourselves contributed approximately $2 billion helping the French maintain their domination of the Vietnamese, did we not, between 50 and 54?
A considerable sum. I don't have the figure.
Well, it's been stated here, and it doesn't matter, but it was a considerable sum. It's rather odd that when we revolted against the British, the French helped us throw off the British role, didn't we?
Roles change in history, Senator.
Yeah, roles do change in a most peculiar manner. And I don't recall in all our history where we ever tried to assist a colonial power to retain its domination of its colony. Do you?
No, but again, I would only, for the record, remind us all that we're not talking about the situation at that time. We're talking about the communist colonialism, which is now being attempted to assert itself.
I agree, General, and I don't wish to argue about your strategy as to how we now defeat what you call the enemy, and they are obviously become our enemy. They weren't necessarily so at that time, back in 1946. But this is what worries a great many people. These are the questions the other day in other hearings has been whether or not we're justified in the position we've taken here.